Shooting operation involving two Palestinians at the entrance of Al-Quds left at least three Israelis dead and over a dozen injured. Some of the injured are said to be in critical condition. Both Palestinians were shot dead by the regime forces. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas claimed responsibility for the shooting attack. Hamas said the operation came as a natural response to unprecedented crimes committed by Israel in Gaza and against prisoners in the regime jails. The Islamic Jihad has also reacted to the operation, saying it confirms that the options for resistance are, quote, open and multiple, and the enemy's obstacles will not protect its security. Elsewhere, in a car ramming operation in Jordan Valley, a Palestinian seriously injured two Israeli soldiers. The fighter was killed during the operation. Tensions are running high in the occupied territory since Israel launched its war in Gaza on the 7th of October. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details on the retaliatory operations. Let's take a listen.
Two Palestinians arrived near the settlement in Al-Quds, carried out a shooting, killed three Israelis, including one rabbi, and wounded a number of Israelis. They first were speaking about a dozen of the Israelis had been wounded. Then they claimed that only eight Israelis had been wounded. Two of them are in serious condition. However, we are sure that they revealed that three Israelis had been killed. Then the second operation, and those two Palestinians who carried out the shooting were brothers from Sur Bahir inside Al-Quds, Palestinians with a Al-Quds ID and not from the occupied West Bank. They were members of the Hamas movement, as the Israelis are had immediately revealed, and they were ex-Palestinian prisoners. Immediately, the Israeli forces raided Sur Bahir, arrested family members of those two martyrs. And then comes the second operation at a military checkpoint near Tobas. This Palestinian, before he was shot and killed by the Israeli forces, rammed his vehicle and wounded at least two Israeli soldiers. Other Israeli forces opened fire and killed him. So it's surprising for the Israelis at a time. Strict measures are being carried out across the occupied West Bank.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas and Israel have agreed to extend the truce agreement moments before the deal was due to expire. In a statement, Hamas said there was an agreement to extend the truce for a seventh day. The Israeli military also said the operational pause will persist in light of the mediator's efforts to continue the process of releasing the detainees and subject to the terms of the framework. The initial four-day truce went into effect last Friday. The truce agreement has already seen the release of nearly 310 people from both sides. The Israeli regime released 30 Palestinians from its jails early Thursday morning. Hamas also released 16 captives. The group included Dutch, German, Russian, and American dual nationals, along with four Thais. Palestinians in occupied West Bank city Ramallah rejoiced the freedom of inmates. Let's take a listen to some of the Palestinians who were freed from Israeli jails.
I think the international community no longer cares. I am a prisoner at the age of 21. I should be at university among my family and my people, not in tourist prisons.
I have an indescribable feeling, but the joy will not be complete unless all the prisoners are released. I have a brother inside the prison. My cousins and some of my friends are also in the occupation prisons, and God willing, they will all be released from the prison.
I came to receive my beloved nephew. My four nephews are still in prison, as well as my son, Ahmed Khalaf. My cousin was recently martyred.
Three individuals were martyred today in Jenin, one of whom was my cousin from the Abu al-Wafa family. Despite this, we were happy with my son's release from prison, even though I have another son, Muhammad, who is still in prison. I hope that he, along with my nephews, will be released from prison, God willing.
Palestinians in Gaza City are grappling with severe water shortages. This is one of the several problems that Gazans have been facing since Israel launched its brutal war and imposed a full blockade on the besieged territory in early October. A resident narrates the ordeal the people in Gaza are going through. Let's take a listen.
We live in a densely populated area and suffer from a severe shortage of potable water. but try our best to provide drinking water to the locals using every possible way. Also, we suffer from a lack of fuel necessary for pumping water. We pray to God to make things better and easier for us. There are several obstacles to delivering portable water. Most importantly, the lack of fuel. We try to get fuel through various channels, including purchasing the fuel from various individuals. This hinders the process of pumping water and creates long queues, but we are unable to operate the water pumping station because there's no fuel. The water pumping station has been providing drinking water for locals for the past 20 years. However, this service was ceased due to a shortage of fuel and the unavailability of water tanks. Currently, the water tank can only provide water for this neighborhood and the nearby houses. But people from distant places, like 20 kilometers away, come to fill their containers with water.
Shabbat Rizvi is a political commentator who joins us from Chicago to share with us his thoughts on this. Welcome to the program. You know, the aftermath of the Israeli war is truly phenomenal in the amount of destruction that the Gaza Strip has suffered as a result. And, of course, the infrastructure is at the forefront of this. And when we look at what drives life, the existence of a human being, water is obviously one of them, since we just ran that particular soundbite from a Palestinian there in the Gaza Strip. We know how water has been used as a weapon, actually, by Israel in the past, especially when it comes to the Gaza Strip. But now it's a whole different story. It's much worse. Tell us your thoughts on what Palestinians are dealing with now in terms of how they need to really be given the attention in this, in so many ways, in order for this death toll standing at 15,000 not to increase, which by many accounts many say will, if things like water, like electricity, and failure to deal with the health side of things will obviously amount to increase in deaths.
I mean, it's a pretty horrific equation here. Let's talk about just very quickly before the war, right? You already had the majority of the water that was coming into the Gaza Strip. It was contaminated. The majority of it was contaminated. It was causing sickness. And then you had the Israeli occupation, even limiting access to food and construction materials. Very specifically, their ministers called it putting Palestinians on a diet, and that's exactly what they called it. Now, as you said, it's a completely different equation where, you know, the infrastructure was already terrible, but now it's been bombed. It's been bombarded. It's almost non-existent. And so you'll have this new demands raised. And also, the international community will be watching now more than ever that this besieged strip, this besieged strip that has been just completely occupied under surveillance and just cut off from the rest of the world for years, is now under a humanitarian crisis. The World Health Organization even says that, you know, more Gazans are probably going to die from disease and lack of resources than they actually are from the bombs themselves, which is horrific. And I think this really highlights just the criminality of the occupation. It really highlights just how horrific and sinister the measures carried out by the Israeli regime against the Palestinians are. And they can say all they want that, oh, we want to cooperate, we want to help out the Palestinian people, we just don't agree with Hamas. And we all know that these are just, you know, false accusations and false statements in order to slowly but surely carry out an ethnic cleansing. But the international community is now becoming completely aware, the people of the world are becoming completely aware of just how criminal this occupation is. And it also, it's worth mentioning that these infrastructure, they were specifically targeted. The water stations were targeted. Buildings that, you know, generated electricity were targeted. From the very first week on, they cut off the electricity. And then now you also have the equation of how they get this information out to the rest of the world. If the Israeli occupation is able to cut off internet access at the flip of a switch, then what does that really say about the level of occupation they have over the Palestinian people? It says that not only are they capable of cutting off, you know, their water, their life-saving resources, but they're also willing to cut off the very methods of the Palestinians communicating their dire situation to the rest of the world.
Thank you for that. Shabbat Rizvi, political commentator from Chicago. We appreciate that. Moving on, divisions seem to be growing among European countries over their support for Israel's deadly war on the besieged Gaza Strip. Spain's prime minister says that he has serious doubts that Israel is abiding by international humanitarian law in the war. Pedro Sanchez expressed concern about the high number of casualties among civilians in Gaza, in particular children. He said the situation in the Strip was unacceptable. The Spanish Prime Minister also referred to Israel's settlement expansion in the West Bank. Sanchez said that Israel has systematically occupied the Palestinian territory. He also called on the European Union to recognize Palestine as a state.
It is obvious that we must find a political solution to put an end to this crisis, and this solution requires, in my opinion, the recognition of the Palestinian state.
The Spanish Prime Minister has already said if there is no consensus among the 27 member states of the European Union, Spain does not rule out unilateral recognition of a Palestinian state. Spain's parliament voted in 2014 in favor of a resolution calling for the recognition of Palestine as a state. The vote was non-binding. Iran's foreign minister says Islamic countries need to continue efforts to permanently stop Israel's war crimes in the besieged Gaza Strip. Hossein Emri Abdullahian underscored the need to expand humanitarian corridors into the Palestinian territory. He called on the UN Security Council to fulfill its duty towards the people of Palestine by issuing an effective resolution. Emri Abdullahian made the comments in a phone call with his counterpart, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan of the United Arab Emirates. The Emirati official said that his country will go to great lengths to extend the ceasefire and further facilitate delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Top diplomats also discussed bilateral relations of cooperation. The Iranian foreign minister has lashed out at the UN Security Council, saying the 15-member body has failed to fulfill its legal and moral responsibilities toward Palestinians and their cause. Hossein Emri Abdullahian said the U.S. should be largely blamed for such a failure because of Washington's all-out support for Israel and attempts to prevent measures to hold the regime accountable. The top Iranian diplomat reiterated that more than 17 years of Israeli blockade on Gaza and the killing of thousands of innocent people constitute a threat to international peace and security. Emir Abdullahian said indiscriminate bombardment of Gaza using banned weapons like phosphorus bombs amounts to war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. He said the Israeli occupation, which was institutionalized in 1948, caused the forced displacement of 1 million Palestinians. Emir Abdullahian made the comments in a letter addressing a U.S. Security Council session, which he was unable to attend due to a delay in visa delivery. November 29 marks an international day of solidarity with the Palestinian people. Rallies have been held in many countries on the occasion to support the Palestinian cause and to demand an end to Israel's war on Gaza. Thousands of South Africans marched through the streets of the country's biggest city, Johannesburg, to call for a permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. In Moscow, people gathered in front of the Palestinian embassy to commemorate the International Solidarity Day with the Palestinians. In Paris, a pro-Palestine rally turned violent after members of a Jewish students' union clashed with them in front of the Paris Institute of Political Studies. Also, Pakistan's southern city of Karachi witnessed a huge rally on Wednesday, bringing together people from diverse backgrounds in support of Palestinians. Former U.S. Secretary of State and noted diplomat Henry Kissinger has died. Kissinger, who served Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, was even consulted by later presidents on international issues. But a dark cloud had descended on his legacy and reputation as the former top American diplomat supported coups, dictators, and wars around the world.
Henry Kissinger, influential American politician and career diplomat, has died at the age of 100. Kissinger served as both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State under President Richard Nixon and continued as Secretary of State under Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford. However, he left a dark legacy ranging from supporting dictators and terror squads to directing coups and ordering war crimes. Kissinger is known for his role in carpet bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War, which caused the death of 150,000 civilians in a neutral country. Indiscriminate bombing campaign was expressed in Kissinger's infamous order to an American general when he said, quote, anything that flies and anything that moves. The civilian death toll in Cambodia was more than those killed in U.S.-led wars against several West Asian countries over the past two decades. Kissinger's genocidal campaign also enabled the rise of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge dictatorship. Yet, ironically enough, Kissinger was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for ending a war which he had blood on his hands. Kissinger was also involved in a CIA-hatched coup against Chile's socialist leader, Salvador Allende, in 1973. The coup was followed by a regional campaign of political repression and assassination in South America, dubbed Operation Condor. That resulted in the killing of 50,000 people, as well as disappearance and imprisonment of nearly 500,000 people in several South American countries under U.S. ally dictatorships. Kissinger also supported former West Pakistan dictator Yahya Khan, whose army carried out a massive genocidal campaign against Bengali-speaking people in East Pakistan that led to the 1971 war and finally the creation of Bangladesh. Kissinger's other infamous moves include his support for Indonesian leader Suharto, who invaded East Timor in 1975. Tens of thousands of Timorese people were killed in two decades of occupation initiated by Suharto. Kissinger also presided over a writing of a secret national security memo in 1974 recommending the U.S. government to force depopulation on third world countries to weaken their national power, ensure America's access to their resources, and prevent young population rising against U.S. imperialist control. After leaving government in 1977, Kissinger remained a prominent voice in foreign policy circles for decades. Even into his late 90s, he continued attending global events, consulting business clients, and privately advising American presidents. He has been lauded for his incredibly sharp memory and unique analytic powers, but his bloody record is a testimony that superior human intelligence combined with inferior moral sensitivities can be a source of incredible evil rather than good.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files.
Around 2 a.m. on the morning of Saturday, November 28, 1953, something rather strange happened at a New York City hotel. A scientist got up in the middle of the night, ran across a dark room, avoiding two beds, and dove through a closed window with the shades and curtains down, then died soon after he hit the ground. His name was Frank Olson, and his death would help uncover a series of secret CIA operations involving the lives of thousands. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today's mind-blowing topic is a CIA mind control project called MKUltra. The story of MKUltra is at times so surreal that one may think it's the plot of a science fiction movie, but unfortunately, it is very much true and affected thousands of people around the world, although no one is sure of the actual numbers because of the secrecy of the program. It was a Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, top secret program, which used humans as guinea pigs to test a range of drugs that could force confessions or brainwash individuals through various forms of psychological torture. Well, you see, in the 1950s, the CIA initiated this program to experiment with forms of mind control in order to, and I quote, to catch up with the Soviets and Chinese advances in the field. 80 institutions and 185 private researchers had contracts with the CIA to perform this work, and they were located around the world, as were their victims. So Sidney Gottlieb was the CIA's main man handling this project. He was a chemist, and some of his experiments were covertly funded at universities and research centers. Others were conducted in American prisons and in detention centers in Japan, Germany, and the Philippines. Now, according to journalist Stephen Kinzer, Gottlieb wanted to create a way to seize control of people's minds, and he realized that it was a two-part process. Well, first, you had to blast away, imagine that, blast away the existing mind. Second, you had to find a way to insert a new mind into that resulting void. According to Kenzer, the United States didn't get too far on number two, but they did a lot of work on number one. There were a core group of scientists around the world who were part of MKUltra. LSD, sleep deprivation, and electric shock treatments were their favorite tools to use on their victims, but it was not limited to those. They would induce people into a high with putting them into having hallucinations, then giving them a drug to bring them down, and while in between these phases, some of them would give their victims many electric shock treatments, basically having people lose their minds. Take a look at this.
This is where I have my effect, in the mind.
This is lysergic acid diethylamide, better known as acid. The powerful drug was first synthesized in 1938 in Switzerland. With a dose of mere micrograms, the mind becomes confused. Perception is distorted. Personal identity is called into question. The results can be euphoric bliss or deadly panic.
So that was how LSD was introduced to this country.
Operation Midnight Climax is part of a larger top-secret CIA program called MKUltra. The goal: learn how to control and even reprogram people's minds. The CIA believes LSD might hold the key. Over the next 10 years, the agency doses a cross-section of the American public. Everyone from unwitting housewives to soldiers to even criminals like gangster Whitey Bulger is tested.
You know, what the CIA really dreamed of was sort of like a drug you could give to someone, get them to commit all sorts of unspeakable acts, and they wake up the next day and they don't remember what they've done.
They were looking into brainwashing. They were looking into mind control. They were looking into how they could create what they called Manchurian candidates. They were trying to figure out if they could get people to go out and do things that they would ordinarily not do, like assassinations.
The case of MKUltra has to be one of the craziest cases of blowback in CIA history. Because here they took this drug, LSD, and thought that they were going to be able to use it to control people's minds. And the unbelievable irony is that LSD is a drug that does exactly the opposite. It frees your mind and causes people to question authority.
Turn on, tune in, drop out.
The CIA's attempt to control people turned out to be... just the opposite. It created the counterculture as we know it of the 60s. It was the CIA that introduced LSD to the United States.
So not only was the goal of this program brainwashing, but also reprogramming to get the victim to do anything the CIA wanted, even assassinations, and without the victim having the slightest memory of what he had done. The United States was concerned during the Korean War, where many American prisoners of war were confessing to the Koreans that they had actually used germ warfare on their country and were apologetic. Over 7,000 POWs petitioned the U.S. to end the war, and 21 of the soldiers even refused to return to the United States after the war. Well, Washington thought all of this was because of brainwashing techniques, which they thought had been used on the soldiers, but that was not the case. However, it did not prevent the U.S. from starting this aggressive and inhumane program to learn how to control humans by brainwashing them. Officially, the MKUltra program ended when information started seeping out after Olson's case was finally looked into. You know, he was the guy I introduced to you at the beginning of the program, the scientist who was set up to look like he committed suicide, but were most likely killed by the same CIA that he had worked for. It seemed that after he was given an LSD dosage that he had a bit of a conscience and couldn't take the torture to others any longer. And Gottlieb and others, even higher up, knew that he needed to be silenced before he exposed what they were doing. Much about this program came to light 20 years after Olson's death, and because of the public exposure, the program was officially ended. However, there are those who say it never really ended, but just took on other forms. Let's get my guests involved in this discussion.
James Martinez is a media ecologist, radio talk show host, and pioneer in radio broadcasting and behavior modification. Born in San Diego, California, he's an accredited member of the Press for American Media Distribution. Martinez has been a consultant for True TV's Conspiracy Theory and has consulted for Emmy Award-winning actor Ian Bailey for a show entitled Imagine This.
Oh, thank you so much, James, for being with us. I'd like to start off with this. How would you describe MKUltra to our audience?
MKUltra was brought over from Europe during World War II, where they're perfecting behavior modification using child abuse and satanic cult ritual. Those were the melting pots for what was to be used. Originally, most people think MKUltra had to do with being able to utilize behavioral software to override the conscious mind of an individual that was pre-programmed for instance, assassination. But it wasn't only for assassination. It was used for political purposes as well. And it was done through ritualistic abuse originally. That's how it started. These ritual abuse techniques were used to create deep-seated trauma within the psyche, and then around the trauma, build and program personalities for certain functions to be used. MKUltra, originally, what people know it from is being able to take the free will of an individual, any individual, and get them to commit murder without them knowing it or even remembering it, and carrying it out skillfully and discreetly so that it can be utilized for political purposes, for altering the chessboard pieces on the grand chessboard, so to speak. That's what it was for originally, but it has far more profound effects today.
I mean, that's really mind-boggling what you said. How successful would you say that program was?
Very successful. Very successful. In 1990, when I was working with Walter Boehrert, we had interviewed hundreds of people that survived ritualistic satanic abuse. Some were in the private sector, some were in the military, and some were utilized in Vietnam for assassination. And Walter Boehrert originally, what inspired him to write the book was discovery of deep-seated amnesia with a lot of the soldiers that came back from Vietnam. And he was always very sensitive to the whole idea of warfare as a whole. But what he really, really was concerned about was the battle over the mind. And we knew in 1990 that that's where the high ground was, and the end of the road, and we've reached that now. We knew in 1990 that free will, freedom of speech, and cognitive liberty would be the biggest issues on the planet. And this today is where we're at, because we are now in the process of merging our central nervous system to technology. And this is, we're at a very, very dangerous place for the whole human race at this point.
Well, besides the drugs used in the MKUltra program, I saw in an earlier interview that you had done, you talked about child abuse techniques also used. Can you expand on that for me?
When you have individuals in society that get off on having power over others as a mechanism of an effect, of satisfaction to the psyche, most of the time it's because they're disassociated from previous childhood that they experienced as a youngster. Whether it was sanctioned by the government or done through a program, these type of individuals come into power, and then what ends up happening is they have no empathy or even feeling for anything outside of themselves, because they've been fractured themselves. And everybody has heard the term, you know, those that have been abused, abuse. And this is what we have today. And it was weaponized, MKUltra, and all the programs associated with it, MK Naomi and all the others, were utilized against the public to capture America and then the world.
Well, you just mentioned about mind control techniques transcending. And you've also said about the role technology plays in all of this, technology and media. Let's talk about this a little bit. What do you mean exactly?
Marshall McLuhan wrote Understanding Media. He spoke before the Bilderbergs and the most powerful people in the world on the effects of technology on human perception. And this is a very important piece of the puzzle in understanding mind control, is being understand the what's known today as media ecology, which is the study of human perception and its marriage to technology. And we knew in the early 90s when they began to outer the inner, that's it called, of the central nervous system outside of the body via the computer, the media extension of our central nervous system, our handheld computers, that was the beginning of the end. And human perception would be altered forever because of that, all of which was planned by DARPA and the military industrial complex quite some time ago. So if people are trying to understand how this functions, they really need to study the works of Marshall McLuhan and other media theorists in the communications field, so they understand how human perception is altered through media environments, such as the television, the book, the computer, any media extension of the human psyche alters it. And they're aware of that. All the intelligence agencies were all told this in the 50s. They figured it all out, and they slowly utilized technology to alter and steer obsolescence and human perception and attention span, because now we're in an attention economy. And that's been offset by the amplification of our central nervous system to put us into an anticipation state all the time of receiving a text, receiving a message, receiving. And this is ADHD is an effect of the post-information environment and the computer, which we spoke about in Operation Mind Control.
I mean, if what you're saying is true in your perspective, what can be done to counter these measures?
It's incredibly damaging. I have kind of stayed away from a lot of the news, as I did a media fast by design, to unplug myself from everything. And that's what you need to do to have contrast and being able to survive in a post-information environment where everything now is inverted, information's moving at the speed of light, everything changes every second, human perception is being engineered and designed, and we've got the birth of the cybernetic being now, which is completely, totally different than what was previously there 5-10 years ago. We have different humans now. The days of the organic biological entity that we call a human being, it's gone. It's been re-engineered. Now it's being done genetically. So mind control now is not just taking over the mind, it's taking over the entire biology of an individual and re-engineering it for either extermination or for some policy to support the state. So the most important, not discussed issue of our time right now is the liberation of the human condition and what it is to be human. Because a lot of us don't know anymore, because we've been so damaged by the technology that's been inserted into the public. You've spoken to enough people and watched culture close enough yourself to see that what's been done to our children just by the interfacing of technology in their development years. What, you know, a lot of children grew up with a cell phone in their hand. That's a completely different reality and a different nervous system. Their nervous systems have been retuned for something else. They've been retuned to blend in so that their memories and personality will be on the cloud in the future. So the big discussion is, and should be all over the world, is where are we going, what are we doing, and why are we doing it based upon a few people's idea of what a human being should be.
It's really amazing what you're saying. Do you have any final thoughts?
Freedom of your mind and the liberation of the human condition. This is the high ground of the military-industrial complex and the New World Order. And if you do not, and people do not, address these issues, now you're not going to have free will. You're not going to have freedom. You're not going to have a right to rule and create a future that you want. This is, a lot of people have sacrificed to bring this information to the public a long time ago, and people have really put themselves out there because they know at this moment in our history, this is the crossroads of either the beginning and liberation of the human condition or the complete and total slavery of it. So I would suggest everybody start to examine it and take a real close look at it and start taking action from themselves. Don't expect any elected employee to do anything because they've failed miserably, totally, completely. Specifically, I'm talking about the United States. Take it upon the individual self to take control of their own reality, take full responsibility, and then move ahead. That's what I suggest. That's my leading parting message for everybody.
Well, thank you very much, James Martinez, for a very interesting discussion. Well, listening to Mr. Martinez can only make us wonder how controlled all of our minds are right now. We're also connected to our screens. Is this the new form of brainwashing? Well, the original sin of torturing people and destroying thousands of lives was really never addressed. There were some families who were compensated, but the majority were not. And of course, the victims can never, ever be fully compensated. Now, this brings up the question that although the CIA says its MKUltra program no longer exists, what would stop it from using other inhumane techniques to reach a goal? It used biological warfare in the past and never really had to pay for it. What does that mean for us today? Are they in the business of creating germ warfare? It was said that the MKUltra program was so extensive that it even developed biological weapons in the form of aerosol sprays, and that all types of poisons and drugs were created, combined, and tested on humans. And that was then, in the 1950s and 60s. What about now?
March 16th, 2018. The U.S. government's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, commonly known as DARPA, announces a bold initiative to develop what they call next-generation non-surgical neurotechnology. It is designed to allow the human brain to directly interface with machines.
We know that DARPA is exploring human-machine interfaces that include direct connections between the brain and outside systems. That's been from the beginning of DARPA's information technology mission, and it continues to this day. DARPA has created some of the most influential technologies of all time, things that we use and take for granted every day, including the project that became the internet. They've created self-driving cars, stealth technology, GPS that fits in your pocket. That's DARPA's specialty, to imagine the future and create it.
A new technology that is actually very much on the verge of being a reality that is being fielded is we could have a sensor maybe on the surface of our head or maybe implanted somewhere in our body, in our brain or something that allows us to interact directly with our communications gear, our processing gear, our weapon systems, and so on. But now imagine we take that technology and we can control robots at a distance with it. Even fly drones, you put this sensor on and you think the right way and you can increase the speed of the fan by thinking and controlling that thought with direct-to-mind or mind-machine interfacing. With that type of capability, you could control all sorts of buttons and mechanisms in equipment.
Mind-machine interfaces will have many applications in both civilian and military life. But there are those who believe that this same technology could also be used by DARPA as a new form of mind control. like their counterparts at the CIA, DARPA-funded researchers have spent decades investigating how the human mind can be altered. In 1965, DARPA launched Project Pandora, which studied the possibility of using microwave radiation to control human behavior. The project reportedly ended in 1969, but DARPA's investigation of how machines can affect and possibly control the brain continues to this day.
750,000 dollars. That's how much the Olson family was compensated for the assassination of Frank Olson by the CIA back in 1975, which is ironic because it seems the only murder that was compensated and apologized for in this manner was the murder of a scientist who himself was guilty of creating bioweapons responsible for the murder of many others. Well, in Canada alone, of the 300 victims who filed for compensation, 250 were turned down with the excuse of not having been affected badly enough or for filing too late or for the lack of medical records, which the CIA had conveniently destroyed. But these victims are only a fraction of those who were severely injured and killed by the similar scientific experiments on human beings without their knowledge and consent. Because in addition to these human guinea pigs and the some 7,000 U.S. soldiers used for these experiments, there were thousands more who paid the price for the projects approved by the American government. People in Korea and elsewhere who received the final product which resulted from these experiments. The most voiceless victims of the CIA's biological warfare were these non-Americans whose suffering didn't seem to be an area of concern as they were citizens of the so-called enemy countries. You see, the most dangerous brainwashing method is not that which was done using LSD and other drugs and terror techniques, but the media propaganda that dictates to people every single day which lives should matter and which ones are simply all the expendables. Perhaps it's time for us to unplug ourselves from all the noise from the screens and give our minds time to process what is reality and what is a creation of cyberspace. Be able to discern the real from the created is the test of the day. And depending on how well we score, it can help determine if we can free our minds or simply behave like a puppet on a string giving in to the whims and directions of others on the web. Well, with that, it brings us to the end of this week's show. And we hope you will be joining us for our next Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye for now.
In the limelight.
And the U.S. influential caucus workers backed Nikki Haley in the GOP presidential primary. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Americans for Prosperity Action, a libertarian conservative political policy network founded by the billionaire Koch brothers, has endorsed Nikki Haley's presidential campaign on Tuesday, 28th of November. The group's endorsement provides an influx of resources and support for Nikki Haley as she looks to establish herself as the clear challenger to former President Donald Trump. Americans for Prosperity said the endorsement will include a multi-million-dollar advertising campaign launched this week in all early and several Super Tuesday states calling on Americans to unite behind Nikki Haley's positive vision to turn the page on today's broken politics and move our country forward. Its first advertisement supporting Haley on digital and television on Tuesday, 28th of November, touts the former South Carolina governor as a fiscal conservative who will take on reckless spending from both parties and says that Donald Trump and President Joe Biden had their chance. They can't fix what's broken. Americans for Prosperity told reporters in a call on Tuesday it has already contacted more than 6 million voters in America about the 2024 race and claimed it has the largest grassroots operation in the country and a presence in all 50 states. The organization provided polling that suggests Nikki Haley's political identity is not as well known, which Americans for Prosperity said is a strength, not a disadvantage. As voters have gotten to know more about her, her favorable ratings as well as her ballot share has only increased, Americans for Prosperity senior advisor Michael Palmer said. Palmer added, in these early states, and then particularly going into South Carolina and Super Tuesday, it's much easier to define or to craft a narrative around a blank state with which people don't know about versus a book that's already written, which is the case with Donald Trump and also the case to a certain extent with Governor Ron DeSantis. Americans for Prosperity officials previously indicated they were looking for a Trump alternative, writing in a memo in February that the best thing for the country would be to have a president in 2025 who represents a new chapter. Americans for Prosperity did not endorse in the 2020 presidential race. Americans for Prosperity polling showed that since August, support for Ron DeSantis has fallen in Iowa and New Hampshire, while support for Nikki Haley has risen. Congratulations to Donald Trump on securing the Koch endorsement, Ron DeSantis' communications director Andrew Romeo posted on Tuesday morning, arguing that Nikki Haley is a moderate who has no mathematical pathway of defeating the former president. DeSantis himself has previously argued that Haley's electorate doesn't cut as much into Trump's voter base as his does. Every dollar spent on Nikki Haley's candidacy should be reported as an in-kind to the Trump campaign, Romeo said. Haley's team quickly reacted and threw the Florida governor's words during a Fox News interview back at him when he touted his own endorsement by Iowa evangelical leader Bob Vanderplaats. If somebody endorses somebody other than you, you don't always have to lash out and attack the person who made the endorsement. It's a primary. People can have different choices in this, and there's not always an ulterior motive, DeSantis said on Monday, 27th of November. Trump's super PAC, Make America Great Again, said the DeSantis campaign finally got it right when they bitterly attacked Americans for Prosperity for being a vessel of globalist shills, and noted Americans for Prosperity's backing of DeSantis in his gubernatorial campaigns. American for Prosperity's affiliated super PAC spent more than $69 million in the 2022 cycle, according to the Federal Election Commission disclosures. Americans for Prosperity Action has spent over $4.1 million on advertising this cycle, according to Ad Impact. Since early October, it has had a digital advertisement running in Iowa that says, "We can't beat Joe Biden until we let go of Donald Trump." The announcement by the billionaire PAC group comes just weeks ahead of the Iowa caucuses and underscores the ramping up of endorsements and suggests the Republican race is beginning to coalesce. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and Vanderplaats backed Ron DeSantis in November, while New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu could soon be making an endorsement from his state. The cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered this story. The influential network associated with billionaire Charles Koch will throw its money and influence behind former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in the Republican presidential primary, the group announced on Tuesday, 28th of November. The decision could dramatically reshape the Republican field roughly 7 weeks before the Iowa caucuses, As Americans for Prosperity Action deploys its vast resources and standing army of conservative activists on behalf of the former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. The endorsement marks the latest sign that powerful Republican donors are coalescing behind the candidacy of the former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Nikki Haley has seen prominent figures join her campaign in recent weeks, particularly after South Carolina Senator Tim Scott exited the race. Earlier this year, Americans for Prosperity Action, a political arm of Cox Network, pledged to back a single contender in the GOP presidential primary for the first time in its history, and it made clear that it would bypass former President Donald Trump in its quest to find what Emily Zeidel, a top American for Prosperity official, called a president who represents a new chapter. When we announced our decision to engage in our first ever Republican presidential primary, we made it clear that we'd be looking for a candidate who can turn the page on our political dysfunction and win. It's clear that candidate is Nikki Haley. We can't keep looking to the politicians of the past to fix problems of today. Nikki Haley represents a new generation of leadership and offers a bold, positive vision for our future. Americans for Prosperity Action is proud to be endorsing her, and we will be doing everything we can to help her make the next president of the United States. The effort will begin with a multi-multi-million-dollar advertising campaign in support of Nikki Haley launched this week in all early and several Super Tuesday states, and the group touted its data capabilities, including a contact database with millions of American voters and its extensive grassroots reach. Zeidel did not disclose a budget on behalf of Nikki Haley, but the network has spent hundreds of millions of dollars in previous election cycles, rivaling the financial might of the Republican National Committee, the RNC. Nikki Haley herself issued a statement saying, "Americans for Prosperity Action members know that there is too much at stake in this election to sit on the sidelines. This is a choice between freedom and socialism, individual liberty and big government, fiscal responsibility and spiraling debt. We have a country to save, and I'm grateful to have Americans for Prosperity Action by my side." This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian resistance fighters have conducted retaliatory operations in the occupied territories amid ongoing Israeli atrocities. Spain's prime minister has reiterated that the European Union needs to recognize the state of Palestine to help end the crisis in the region. And Iran hits out at the UN Security Council over the war in Gaza, saying the body has failed to fulfill its legal and moral responsibilities toward Palestinians.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Palestinian fighters in the occupied territories have conducted two retaliatory operations amid growing anti-Israeli sentiment in the region. A shooting operation involving two Palestinians at the entrance of Al-Quds